Today on the 21st Show, the issue of abortion is often framed in religious terms, usually by people who oppose the procedure. But Illinois philosopher Peter Wenz says there are religious arguments in favor. His book, which came out earlier this year, is called Abortion Rights as the Free Exercise of Religion, The Constitutional Case for Choice. Wenz had another book out this year aiming to teach the philosophy of religion in a way that suits a generation more steeped in science, technology, engineering, and math. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll hear from Peter Wenz for the hour today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. When it comes to abortion, we're used to hearing religious arguments from one side, those who oppose the procedure on moral or theological grounds. But what if the Supreme Court's own expansive view of religious freedom actually protects the right to have an abortion? That is the provocative argument advanced by Illinois philosopher Peter Wenz in his book, Abortion Rights as the Free Exercise of Religion, The Constitutional Case for Choice. Wenz argues the Supreme Court majority that has sided with cake bakers, football coaches, and corporate employers in recent religious freedom cases should logically extend that protection to women seeking abortions. It's a striking reframe of one of our most divisive issues. Peter Wenz has taught around the world, but for nearly 50 years, his home base has been the University of Illinois Springfield. He's an emeritus professor there and the author of multiple books on politics, the environment, and beyond. The abortion rights book came out this summer, which is when we first aired this conversation. Later this hour, we'll talk about another of Wenz's books published this year, one that explores how a generation raised on science and technology approaches the biggest questions about faith, meaning, and the existence of God. Because our program's on tape, no calls, but you can always get in touch. Our email address, talk@21stshow.org. Peter Wenz, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So your new book argues that women have a constitutional right to abortion based on the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. Take us, how do you get from religious freedom to reproductive rights?
Well, first, you have to understand how the Supreme Court views religion. Religion at one time, well, in the medieval time in Europe, from which American culture was ultimately derived, there was just one religion. It was Catholic religion. But then we had the Protestant Reformation. And religion after the wars of religion became something about what the prince would decide was everybody's religion. From that point, religion got to be more and more individualized, so that by the time we had the founding of this country, religion, a person's religion, was identified with the group to which that person belonged. So, for example, someone was exempt from military service if a Quaker or some other religious group that was pacifist. But increasingly, during the 20th century, religion was more individualized, so that you didn't really have to be a Quaker in order to have an exemption from military service. Well, then, if it's individual, what does religion mean? Well, it basically means, and the Supreme Court explained this in 1965, what is your ultimate concern, what you hold more important than anything else, what you would fight for or endure punishment for, regardless of the consequences. And so the limitation on religion was just that you had this view that could not be changed by empirical evidence. It was a view of the universe or of human life or of the place of people in the universe that was your way of seeing the world. And No one could argue you out of it because it wasn't based on actual, you know, facts like is the germ theory of disease. You can't see the germs, but science can show you that they exist. So once you have religion defined in that way, that explains why a person can break the law without being a member of a particular religious group and be accommodated because we have the free exercise clause.
We should talk about some of the cases where this has played out in recent years. I mentioned the cake bakers and the football coaches praying on the field. Talk about some of the patterns you've seen there.
Well, you have a cake baker who claimed that on religious grounds, he did not want to make wedding cakes for same-sex couples because he believed that making the cake, designing the cake and making the cake was a form of speech. And he did not want to be celebrating same-sex marriage when he was opposed to it. He thought that that was wrong in the sight of God. So there was a tension between his rights to avoid speaking the way he didn't want to speak on religious grounds and the couple's rights to be served equally regardless of, and this is according to the law, this was in Colorado. Colorado, like most states, or probably all states, have a law about treating people equally if you are in a commercial setting, and this would be a service of baking the cakes, you shouldn't discriminate against people on the basis of their sexual orientation. And this would be discrimination on sexual orientation. The court ultimately decided that there really wasn't a great deal of harm here because loads of other people would bake cakes for this couple. It wasn't as if these people, the couple, would be shut out of having a wedding ceremony with a professionally baked cake. So the court said, well, it's kind of like, they didn't use these terms, but sort of no harm, no foul, let the religious freedom prevail. And in part, that's because the court thinks that religion is a good thing. We should encourage religion, and they've got some good facts on their side. Justice Alito points out that religious groups were the first to have orphanages in the United States. Many of the hospitals are Saint this and Saint that because a religious organization started it and proceeded to help poor people with their health difficulties. There's also evidence more recently, because we live in an era of despair and loneliness, that people who engage in groups do better in their just physical health as well as mental health when they're in groups rather than isolated. But the groups that help people most statistically are religious groups. And this is true of teenagers too. Teenagers who are disaffected tend to be less disaffected if they're in a religious group, even if they did not come from a religious family, if they become religious themselves, maybe because of a peer who is religious and they join with that peer. So if religion is something that helps people, then it makes reasonable public policy to encourage people to be religious. So given that, if there's kind of a toss-up, you don't want to discriminate against people on the basis of sexual orientation. On the other hand, you want to promote religion. If it's not really hurting those people with a sexual orientation that the religious person objects to, then why not go with religion? So that's part of what's going on here. And that's, you mentioned the football coach. He was an assistant football coach in Bremerton, Washington. And he became a coach after seeing a film, an old film, that depicted a person who became a coach and after each game prayed to God, thanked God, not for victory, win or lose, thanked God, and on the 50-yard line. with a prayer. So he decided to become a coach who did the same thing. He was inspired by this. Well, the school board in Bremerton did not think this was a good idea because we have an establishment clause. Congress shall make no law establishing religion or impairing the free exercise thereof. So they thought that if a football coach in his kind of official uniform and right after the game on the field, at home, it's the high school's home field, is saying a prayer on the 50-yard line with everybody still present, that would seem like the school and the school district were encouraging religion in a way that violated the establishment clause. It would seem like making that religion the school's religion. So they disallowed it. But the court decided, and this, I think, remains controversial, that there was no harm, no foul in this case, too. But it's not at all clear, because there was a lot of ruckus about this and even some violence in the Supreme Court dissent, because the court decided in favor of this person being able to pray on the 50-yard line. Mm-hmm. And his view was pretty unusual. Praying on the 50-yard line is unusual, but he increasingly insisted that it must be immediately after the game, in the full view of everybody, and done in a demonstrative manner, that this is an unusual pledge to God. But the result was that there was some disturbance, and in the dissenting opinion in the Supreme Court that thought he shouldn't have been able to do this, there are actual photographs of the melee that occurred, at least on one occasion, because of the different views about the propriety of those prayers.
Mm. All right, let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're talking with Illinois philosopher Peter Wenz, whose new book coming out later this month, July 22nd, is called Abortion Rights as the Free Exercise of Religion, The Constitutional Case for Choice. He is an emeritus professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois Springfield. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Okay, I think people, we can follow the argument so far. You're own a masterpiece cake shop. You're against the idea of same-sex marriage. You think it goes against your biblical teachings, perhaps. You don't want to bake the cake. Okay, you're a high school football coach. You want to pray on the field, expressing your personal religious beliefs. Okay, how is it that having an abortion, reproductive health care, also could be in line with someone's religious beliefs? I think that I know that exists in some faith traditions, but it may not be widely understood. So maybe you can take us through that.
Well, the important thing about this, I think, is that it does not depend upon a faith tradition. That's the individualism part. I know of no Church of the Immediate 50-yard line prayer, right? This was his individual pledge to God that the court respected enough to allow it, even though many people, including his boss, thought this violated the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. Well, so now you have a woman who maybe she has some children. Most women who want abortions already do have children. And she may have made a pledge to God to have no more. She may have made this pledge because she thinks that more people on earth are polluting and she's an environmentalist, or she may have had a difficult pregnancy and she pledged to God that if this pregnancy goes well, this will be her last, this is the last child she will have. And that was her pledge to God. So if the football coach can have his druthers because of a pledge to God, why can't she, if she has said, if I get pregnant again, I'll have an abortion, and that was her pledge to God, if he makes this current pregnancy that she was having a successful one? So that's part of it. The other part is the idea of no harm, no foul. How do you know that things aren't harmed? And most people, after all, who are anti-choice, pro-life, would say, but you've got the life of the unborn here, so it can't be no harm, no foul. You're harming because you're killing the unborn. Well, that there are two ways of looking at that. First, looking at that legally, the court, even in its most recent Supreme Court decisions, has not claimed to know or believe or assert that the unborn at every stage of pregnancy is a person with a right to life. They are officially agnostic on that matter until viability. That comes from Roe v. Wade, back in the 70s, but it is also quoted in the most recent decision, the Dobbs decision that removed abortion rights as a constitutional right. Well, if the unborn early in pregnancy, and I would say to be safe during the first half of pregnancy, is not recognized legally as a person with a right to life, then ending that life is not legally recognized as a harm. So if they have a no harm, no foul idea of accommodating people who claim religious beliefs, regardless of their particular institutional relationship with a religious group, then what is standing in the way of her being treated like the football coach?
We need to take a break. We'll continue our conversation with the Illinois philosopher Peter Wenz. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois Springfield and the author of two books this year, including Abortion Rights as the Free Exercise of Religion, The Constitutional Case for Choice. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Peter Wenz. He's an emeritus professor from the University of Illinois Springfield and a philosopher. His book, which came out this summer, is called Abortion Rights as the Free Exercise of Religion, The Constitutional Case for Choice. As the title suggests, he argues that, based on Supreme Court precedents prioritizing religious freedom, there is an argument to be made that the right to an abortion itself is religious choice. We first broadcast this conversation over the summer, so no calls today, but let us know what you thought. Our voicemail line, 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. All right, before the break, we were talking about this idea that the court does not take a position on when life begins. How has that been considered, right? Because we've seen everything from, sort of fetal personhood laws. There's this ancient idea of the quickening. How is that line drawn? How should that line be drawn?
Well, yes, and that's a good, very, I think, central question here. And the court, in setting viability as the standard in Roe v. Wade, and they haven't changed that really at the Supreme Court level, you could question that. Why viability? And I think the idea is that it's certainly part of our established and ineradicable morality that we don't commit infanticide. So we can rule out infanticide. Well, at viability, the unborn is viable outside of the woman who had the pregnancy. So not respecting that life would be kind of like infanticide. So that's why viability. Viability isn't the greatest dividing line, however, because it is subject to change with technology. In 1983, Justice O'Connor thought that viability was going to change back down to practically conception if we develop an artificial placenta so that you can actually remove the unborn as an embryo and have the unborn grow up. And she thought, well, viability is variable. It shouldn't be the standard. And she had a good point there. Well, the other side of this is the variety of views that have been not placed not only on whether there's life, but whether there is the kind of life that we respect enough to say that there is a right to life, a right to continued life, unless there's some other life that is interfering with the continuation of that life. Because after all, we don't respect life in general. I'm sitting here, and in my backyard, there are a bunch of chipmunks and squirrels. And I don't go out and try to kill them, but I'm not going to try to resuscitate them either. They don't have a right to life in our normal view. So why do people, and when do people have a right to life? Well, some people would say it's completely at the time of fertilization, which is often called conception, but actually, technically, there was a difference. Fertilization is the first thing, the time when there is a new genetic code because of the sperm and the ovum combining to make that new genetic code. And that, after all, is a central feature of each of us, that we have a human type genetic code, not exactly the same as one another, but of the same enough type that we're in the same species. And that's what makes for a right to life. Well, the problem with that is, and there's no refutation of it, but I'm just saying the problem is that if you take that view, well, a few problems. One is that after that fertilization, less than half develop to become babies, continue with the pregnancy. More than half, actually perish along the way. Well, if you think that they have a human right to life the same as you and me, from that point, then the greatest challenge of medicine should be trying to save that half, more than half of people who die so young. And I don't think there is really a lot of appetite to do that, especially because though they have a human genetic code, they probably have some difficulties built in, genetic anomalies, that would make their life as people very dependent upon the rest of us who don't have those anomalies. A second thing that's a problem with considering a person to have a right to life, or considering the unborn to be a person with a right to life from the moment of fertilization, is that IVF would be then illegal. I think Louisiana adopted the fertilization standard, and then people said, well, wait, then we can't do IVF, and they made an exception for IVF. It's not obvious what, there's an inconsistency there, because after all, you don't kill people in order to have other people, which logically you would be doing if you thought that from the moment of fertilization, you had a person. So that's why people get off of that and make it a little later, like the six-week standard, which they have in Georgia and in some other states. And that's because something like a heartbeat, it's not exactly a heartbeat, but it's close enough, begins then. But a heartbeat isn't something that we think of, unlike the genetic code, as specifically, peculiarly human, that would justify a right to life. After all, the squirrel has a heartbeat. That doesn't matter. It's because it doesn't have our genetic code that we're not going to try to preserve its life. And you can take any of the quickening. That's when when a woman could feel movement of the unborn, at that point, a fetus in her. And that made sense, I suppose, to verify that there was a pregnancy. They didn't have chemical tests a couple hundred years ago to determine pregnancy. But if you could feel it, okay, now we know that we have an unborn there. And other cutoffs have been suggested, but none except for the genetic code seems to have something peculiarly human until you get to the development of parts of the brain that are particular to human beings, that are special, of the frontal lobe and frontal cortex. And that only starts to differentiate us from other animals in about the 21st week of pregnancy. So that's another possible starting point. The other thing, by the way, about the unborn just from fertilization, the unborn at fertilization is so different from the rest of us. It's microscopic. It's a single cell, and then it gets to be multiple cells. And even with multiple cells, it's still microscopic. It can't do any of the things that we typically think of as human activities. And it can be frozen. And frozen for long periods of time, and then inserted into a woman and grow. So part of the view is that's just too different from the rest of us to think that it's like the rest of us in having a right to life.
Yeah.
But this other standard, the brain development, that makes some sense. They both make some sense. The fertilization and the brain development. Two things both make sense.
So Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson has recently been criticizing her conservative colleagues for what she calls pure textualism that enables them to pursue their policy preferences while claiming neutrality. I guess Justice Alito, you refer to him as sort of a hero of your book, perhaps a little tongue in cheek there, perhaps not. You can talk about that. But I mean, what are the odds that he would accept this argument, since he has been, you know, sort of leading, you know, one of the leading voices on this idea of individual religious liberty?
Well, I'm told on very good authority that the odds are absolutely zero. that's what they say. And they're probably right. It is true that the textualists, and of course, textualism, I should mention, is the view that while interpreting the Constitution or a statute, the court, in order to maintain its legitimacy, should avoid inserting its own value preferences, its own morality, its own preferences for policy into the decision. It should just go by the words that are in the statute or the Constitution, as those words were understood by the people who, in the case of the Constitution, ratified it, or in the case of legislation, passed it, you know, from Congress.
Yeah. And I would go even further. They say that you should also ignore the intent or the sort of values that animated the legislation of the legislators themselves. We don't need to
That's
study
right.
why they were doing this. We only need to look at how exactly they wrote it down.
That's right, because they could have made a mistake. They might have thought, and we see this in economic legislation. We have a bill before Congress now, and supposedly some people say that's going to increase the debt. The administration says it won't increase the debt. So somebody in Congress voting for it could say, no, I'm voting for it because it's going to take care of the debt or reduce it significantly instead of increase it. Well, okay, that may be their intent. Even if they're being, you know, candid, but that doesn't matter. The law is going to be what it is, and what's going to happen is going to happen if people follow the law. And also, the public face of the law is the words of the law, not the psychological predisposition or the aspirations of those who wrote the words. So there is good sense to make a lot of credibility on following the actual words. The problem is that some justices who claim to be originalists, the original meaning of the words, have manipulated their understanding of history to make the words understood by them all out of shape for what they probably meant to the originators. The good example there is the Second Amendment, which starts a militia being essential to the freedom of a state, and then goes on to say that you have a right to bear arms. It would be very hard to find a historian of the period in the 18th century when they wrote that or earlier that would really agree that that meant you had an individual right to have arms for self-defense, because it's talking about a militia. So that's perhaps one of the more egregious examples here. Now, Alito, I don't say this totally in tongue-in-cheek. He has, I think, aspired to promote religion. And that part of it, I agree with. As I said earlier, there's good reason to think that religion is good for people. But I think he has signed on to opinions which completely don't match, and the rest of the originalists have done too, don't match anything in the Constitution. Like, there's nothing in the Constitution that suggests that presidents should, in their official capacity, not be held liable for breaking the law. They should be immune from breaking the law. There's nothing in the Constitution to suggest any such thing. In fact, the whole idea was, we're not going to have a king who can break the law. We're not going to have a king at all. And one of the differences between kings and presidents is that in that era, in the 18th century, kings could break the law. They could make the law. But not so in the United States under our Constitution. So these so-called textualists have actually abandoned the text whenever they thought it was a good idea. And Alito has signed on to it. He hasn't actually written those opinions, but he's joined the vote in favor of the decision.
Just a couple of minutes left before we need to take a break. And then I do also want to talk about your other book. But, you know, so if there is not, you know, if legal scholars think there's not much of a chance of this passing, what are you hoping to accomplish with this book?
Oh, well, historically, ideas that went against the court's current view have prevailed ultimately. There was a time when you couldn't have the New Deal legislation because the court thought that the Equal Protection Clause disallowed states from interfering with free enterprise. And that changed in 1937. At that time, in the 30s, Thurgood Marshall was starting to make the case that ultimately ended up in Brown v. Board of Ed that disallowed official segregation in schools. But the court was totally against that sort of thing, but it prevailed 20 years later. In 1953, it was determined by good evidence in psychology that people who are gay or lesbian are otherwise the same as everybody else. Their personality profiles were basically the same. Whereas previously it had been thought that if you had same-sex attraction, you were generally deranged, and we had to protect society from you. So we made that illegal to have same sex. It took from 1953 to 2005 to get that view finally accepted at the constitutional level, so that same sex intimacy became legal throughout the country.
Yeah, Lawrence v. Texas, right? Adults, yeah.
Among consenting adults. Yes, the Lawrence decision. So this is in the frame of the long game of establishing a constitutional right, because I think that consistency will eventually win out.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll have more from my summer conversation with Illinois philosopher Peter Wenz. His book is Abortion Rights as the Free Exercise of Religion, The Constitutional Case for Choice. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Peter Wenz. He's an emeritus professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois Springfield. He published two books this year, Abortion Rights as the Free Exercise of Religion, The Constitutional Case for Choice, and Philosophy of Religion for a STEM Generation. I spoke with Wenz over the summer. We did take calls live on that broadcast. You'll hear that later on in this segment. But because it's on tape, we're not taking calls today. You can still get in touch. talk@21stshow.org is our email address. talk@21stshow.org. You describe yourself as an aging leftist, feminist, atheist, environmentalist, vegetarian. Talk to me, and yet earlier in the show you said you think there is a value to religion. That might strike some people as a dichotomy. So talk about maybe your own background and how that's informed how you've come to think about these issues.
Well, I was raised as a Reformed Jew, and when in that era, and when I say that era, I'll be 80 next month. So to just give you an idea, we're talking about the 50s. Reform Judaism was very reform. There really wasn't a necessity to believe that there is a God in the traditional sense of some intellect that can watch over you, can hear your prayers, respond to your prayers, who's responsible for the existence of the universe. That some people believed that in the group, and other people did not. So I was not raised to be a theist, but neither was I raised to disdain theists.
Christopher Hitchens describes himself as not an atheist, but an anti-theist, he has said, or had said.
Yes, I'm not an anti-theist. Christopher Hitchens and some other people have been in recent decades. I think theism's a good thing, just I'm not convinced. So the original title for this book, before it became a textbook, and it became a textbook without that many changes, was supposed to be a trade book, a book for the general public. And I still hope that people in the general public would find it readable. And my original title was An Atheist's Guide to Belief in God, because when I grew up, I thought that science would answer the questions that religion poses. You know, where did everything come from? Do we have free will? Where does morality come from? Where does consciousness come from? And conscience come from? I thought that these big questions would be, why is there life in the universe? These big questions would be answered by science. So I, you know, looked at the science as a 15-year-old and didn't make much sense of any of it, but I figured, well, eventually I will. So I finally got back to thinking about this, and I found that the science is no more conclusive, no more convincing than the theistic account of all of these same matters in religious terms, creation and the creation of life and consciousness and free will and so forth. So it occurred to me that this is kind of closer to a tie than it is to a takeover by science of answers to questions originally raised by religion. And so the inspiration of the book was first to see whether science could do this, and then to discover that it couldn't. So many aspects of science rely on random events. We know this in the theory of evolution. We consider the particular combination of genes that end up with bisexual reproduction to be random. But this goes to physics as well. There is a uniform cosmic radiation. Well, why? Well, it's because the universe expanded so quickly and it's different some places than others. Why? Well, that's random. The creation, we have the super colliders try to figure out how the universe began. Well, and what the great energy of the super collider does is create particles and antiparticles. And the antiparticles and the particles, when they come back together again, translate back into pure energy or photons, light. Well, then how is it that we have any material? Why didn't it all just become light and stay light? Because within very small fraction of a second, that's what happens in the super collider. Well, there was just an extra positive one, extra electron compared to a positron, which is the anti-electron. And there just happened to be, you know, a billion of each, except for one. There was 1 billion and 1 of the electron and only a billion of the anti-electrons. Well, how do you know that? And it's just, well, a random mistake or something. So science has at its core uncertainty. And that's the theory, for example, of quantum mechanics. The official theory is that radiation takes place from a given atom in an unpredictable, an officially unpredictable. It's not just that we can't predict it. It is actually random. Not everybody believes that. Some people think there are hidden variables and therefore causation could be attributed to this. But in fact, nobody's found causation in this regard. So science doesn't really do a better job of explaining the big questions. And then that leaves open the possibility, a reasonable possibility of faith, of believing that, no, there's a God behind all of this.
Hmm. Although some, I mean, I might argue science doesn't know yet. You could add yet to there. But you think that there is value in faith beyond, and I guess that's part of what the argument in the book is about, or some of the arguments in the book. But talk about this. Yeah, go ahead. This idea of value in faith, even as we continue to gain scientific understanding.
Well, Samantha Guthrie put out a book, I think about a year ago, describing her faith. And she's basically saying that, she doesn't use these words, but it's a way of looking at the world. You can look at the world as a series of causes and effects, or you can look at it additionally, not instead, but in addition, you can look at it, the universe, as God infused. It's, you can see God every place in these causes and effects. I was just watching movie, in this movie, there is a song, 100 million miracles are happening every day. And you can look at the things that Flower Drum Song is the musical, that what has occurred, it seems like there is a bias towards life beginning in the universe. Well, why is that? How did that come to be what is natural? And then consciousness with people, which is quite mysterious. We have no idea how consciousness develops. And so it's not at all irrational to think that there is a God behind all of this. You can't prove it. It's a way of looking at things, but many things that we take for granted are also a way of looking at things. You can't prove that other people have a mind the way you do or have experiences as you do, yet we all believe it. You can't prove that the future will resemble the past because all your memories and all your experiences are in the past. You don't have any experience of the future yet, but we all have that belief. And belief in the existence of God is kind of like that. It's a way of looking at the world without proof that this way of looking at the world is correct. And yet it's very functional for so many people if it is recognized to be a way of looking at the world and not the only way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. If you get too much into belief that you have the sole truth that everyone should share, then that tends to diminish tolerance for other people who don't share it. And this can be your truth that is religious or your truth that is not religious. People can be quite caustic and even get into violence, as during the wars of religion in the 16th and 17th centuries, when you think that your view of the supernatural is the only view and it's essential that everybody hold it because there are supernatural rewards or punishments depending on whether you believe it or don't believe it or act upon it or don't act upon it.
Yeah. All right. There's more to say on this, but I would like to make sure we have some time to get a couple of calls in if we can. So let's go to line one now. Susan is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Susan, thanks for calling long distance today.
Hi. I'd like to say that I think a religious discussion of or abortion as a religious issue is not the right attack. I think it's a biological issue, and the unborn is the offspring of the parents, and it's the same DNA throughout its entire life, a unique individual that can never be replaced. And so I think it is, what should I say, unfortunate, unhealthy, unwise. I don't want to use the term wrong, but it's wrong to do away with an unborn person for whatever reason. And even though, you know, that miscarriages happen all the time, well, we're all going to die. So, you know, death is going to occur to everybody. And I don't think it's justifiable to say, well, abortion is okay because miscarriages happen. So I think there is, you know, no valid reason to justify abortion as, you know, just an issue of choice. Because it's a fact of nature. It's not a law passed by a bunch of men to pregnancy is not a law passed by a bunch of men to punish women. It's just a fact of nature, and I think the unborn should be saved and respected.
Susan, thank you so much for calling and sharing your perspective. Peter, just a couple of minutes left. If you want to respond to what she had to say.
Yes, the first thing, I think that's a perfectly valid perspective. But I think because of the difficulties that are associated with that perspective, there's an alternate perspective. I would say during the first half of pregnancy, you don't have a person yet, that's also a valid perspective. If you think about an argument between people or a discussion, I should say argument, some having the listener's view and some having a view that it starts later, you'd find out that they can agree on all the same facts of development. The biology can be non-contentious, and yet the conclusion can be contentious because it's, again, it's a way of looking at the unborn at fertilization versus looking at the newborn as an embryo versus looking at the newborn as having the distinctively human, not potential, but actuality of brain development. So I think that the case for choice is just the way we have a case for choice in religion. Because you can't prove that your religion is right, you should be humble about your religion, follow your religion. It's good for you to do so long as it's done in a humble way, which is accepts that reality that other people have a different view. And I think that should be the same thing in the case of choice for abortion.
Peter Wenz is an emeritus professor of philosophy from the University of Illinois Springfield. He's the author of Philosophy of Religion for a STEM Generation and Abortion Rights as the Free Exercise of Religion, the Constitutional Case for Choice. Both came out earlier this year. I first spoke with Wenz over the summer. Coming up on tomorrow's show, health insurance is getting more expensive next year. Costs are rising for people on employer plans, Medicare, and especially for those who buy coverage through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. We'll look at what's driving the increases and what it might mean for your coverage. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.